Hi, I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast.
Well, I'm Andy Kumbo Floyd, and I am a writer and an editor, and I have a lot of titles, a writing coach and a historian. But my primary identity is as a writer and a farmer. Mm-hmm. And I write primarily about the history and legacy of slavery in the United States, mm-hmm. Particularly here in Central Virginia, where I live. And I'm interested in that subject because I grew up on what was a slave plantation. And so that space, that geography has shaped who I am in a great way. And I also think it's one of the most pressing social issues today is that legacy. Go ahead.
Yeah, your book, The Slaves Have Names, was that, tell me a little bit, I know you decided to do it based on where you're living and where you grew up, and maybe you can just kind of give us a little summary of what that was about.
Sure. I grew up on this huge plantation. It's still huge, 3,500 acres in Fluvanna County, Virginia. The county has one stoplight, so probably you've never heard of it. And we moved there when I started high school. And when I was in high school, there was a slave cemetery there, and no one hid that, but nobody really talked about it. Nobody talked about the fact that the people that were enslaved there built the houses, cleared the land. I mean, that the wealth of the current owners, who are descendants of the original owners, was built entirely on the backs of enslaved people. And when I got to college and sort of was made more aware of things, that became a curiosity to me. I can't say it became a passion at that point, but I definitely thought it was unusual. And then through a series of events that were only guided by hands, not my own, I ended up working at the Martin Luther King papers and working on civil rights history, and then ended up doing a lot of historical research on enslaved people through a series of events. And so when I moved back home to care for my dying mom, I ended up using that experience to write this book.
Does that have anything to do with the book? That seems to have nothing to do with the book you just wrote, and maybe it's in draft form. Is there a connection between the two, or is this something totally new?
This is something totally new. I've actually finished two books this year, but the one I just finished is a very brief book that will be actually available for free for people who would like it, about writing as a practice. This idea of writing being something that can center you and slow you and help you see. But it's not entirely disconnected from the practice of researching history or coming to terms with history or recognizing the impact of history. I mean, I think those are contemplative practices. I think those are things that we have to sit with in a real way. They're not sort of, it's very hard to see that very easily. You have to really be able to sit with a little discomfort, to be honest. And I think that's enhanced by sort of a contemplative way of being.
And now that you mention that, I have been reconnecting with you a lot more often because of the Contemplative Writers Facebook group, which is, I believe, still, it's not a closed group or anything. It's still open to anybody who wants to join, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, and that's been really, Ed Suzeski kicked that off.
Yes, and that's a wonderful group because it's, people who are, I think there are two worlds of writers, and there's no judgment involved in thinking that. For me, there's people who write for profit, who are writing books to primarily make money from them, which again is fine. I mean, I would love to make more money off my books, but I don't write primarily for that purpose. I mean, and that's what this group is nice. I think it's people like me who are writing because it helps us understand the world. We're writing to help other people understand the world. And I think that's a special thing. I think that's a special thing.
Yeah. And it's, I've seen writing too in my own life, but also in plenty of other people too, as a type of soul care. And that group has been encouraging with, you know, people just kind of checking in now and then with what they're up to or what they're praying about or thinking about and different resources. And I've noticed that it does feel tribal. It does feel like almost like a support group, a soul care support group in a sense, or at least that's how I wind up benefiting from it. And it's interesting what you're saying about being okay with discomfort, and it's sort of the contemplative practice or the way we are sort of apprehending and living in the world is different as a contemplative that maybe some people don't realize, is that you are able to hold tension between disparate things. So something that's, you know, you don't have to push away pain. You can hold it in tension with solace and other things, or you can kind of just sit in mystery a little bit and not have to solve every problem or every, you know, thing. So the idea of not that there isn't a time to take action be active and especially in terms of practical matters and justice and things like that, it's all very important to actually not just sit there but get up and do something. But then I think internally we also have to kind of come to grips with that we aren't going to be able to solve every problem in the world or even in our own hearts. And I don't know if that's something you've ever dealt with or what the contemplative stream of spirituality has meant to you.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. I mean, I just very practically right now, there's a lot of conversation with people I know and love who are just worn down by the events related to race and police activity and racism in general. And honestly, a lot of those people are just have to step back and they have to rest. You know, there is a real place for soul rest and for sitting, you know, for sitting with questions, you know, Rilke's live with the questions and not jumping to action because it's more comfortable to do something than it is to sit and try to think through things. But like you said, obviously action has to come at some point. But I sometimes think too, we think action has to be for justice in particular, we have to march or we have to make a big change. And sometimes I think just speaking, sometimes writing is the way we act. And that isn't to be discounted, you know, that matters. You know, Charles Dickens wrote all those books that changed labor laws, you know, that makes a difference. And so I think we have to balance the two, but I also think that people have different ways of acting and we need to honor that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it sometimes can be overwhelming. I've actually, and I think I read this on your blog lately about saying yes to too many things and wanting to back away from media and social media and things like that. And I have definitely felt in this calendar year, as I've been doing podcasting, I need to get the message out. But in the process of getting the message out, I'm bombarded with what is essentially 80% really bad news, really, really bad news. And not that I want to run away from it, but I also know that being alerted to every horrendous thing isn't going to help me as much as, or anyone else, as much as just me getting deeper relationships with my neighbors and, you know, extending myself locally to people of different cultures and backgrounds in just a really human way. And so I've had to back off too from that inundation of so much information and not nearly enough time to process it all.
Right. Yeah. I just posted a cartoon on Facebook, ironically, the other day that says, I really want to stay informed, but I'm not sure how to do that and keep my sanity.
Right. I saw that. Yeah.
You know, and it's funny, but it's also very true. Like, it's very difficult to be healthy. Like, my husband and I spent the other night talking about money, which normally we would not ever want to do. Who really wants to sit down and figure out budgets and stuff? But because we got so hyper focused on that, neither of us checked our phone, neither of us turned the news on, neither, and we both went to bed that night just thinking, oh, that was really nice, you know. And it's not about, you know, I always think I love Thomas Merton. Mm-hmm. If I could sort of spend time with one person, I know he's dead. You know, should he come back? Mm-hmm. I'd like to sit with him because I feel like he had a way of balancing activism and action with contemplation in a really meaningful way. And he always said, you know, monks don't withdraw from the world to hide. They withdraw to pray. Mm-hmm. And prayer's action. And I always just thought, that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely beautiful. And so, yeah, mm-hmm. I don't think we can all be inundated all the time.
Yeah. And it really is, even the monastic life, except for very cloistered groups, the monastic life is secluded in order to come back out into community and be a difference, you know, be the change you want to see in the world type of thing, where the idea isn't to just hide away. The idea is you're sort of storing up your reserves in a way to be more powerful when you finally come back out, and more healthy for community to have more to give because you've been poured into by God. Mm-hmm. And I think some people who don't, I'm not Catholic, but I have Catholic sympathies and I read a lot of Catholic writers, and I can kind of glean from that without converting so far. I don't think it's going to happen, but I've gained a lot of wisdom from what tends to be Catholic writers drawing on sort of a deeper well of tradition, that some of which was jettisoned in the Reformation. But that's a mistake I think people tend to make, that monasteries are the place where people, or convents, people get away and then you never see them again, and they're not really interacting with the world. They're just kind of off praying forever, and it's seldom is the case.
That's
but
right.
That
yeah.
kind of brings me to, I want to ask you a little bit about God's Whisper Farms. And I'm not sure if you're, I think you've just come off of writing retreat, or maybe you can explain what you're up to there. And I was aware of what you're doing because I've seen posts and things like that, but I hadn't dug into all the material on your website until just before, in the last couple of days, just before we were talking now. And I was like, what? I didn't realize the extent of this. This is really awesome. Like, I got very excited. I'm like, that's it. I'm going to have to visit. I'm just going to have to put it on the calendar and get down there and see what you're up to in person.
Yeah. So, I don't even know. A few years ago, before I met my husband, I was going through a dark time. My first husband had left, and I was sort of floundering, and I was at a tailgate church service at a Mennonite church. I'm Mennonite by conversion, not ethnicity, unfortunately. I don't have that good ethnic name, but and I was at this church, and they were having this, they were Eagles supporters, tailgate party, and I was like, ugh, I'm not a football fan. It's hot. Why are we outside? Like, I just want to be where I'm used to being, in the pew. And the pastor, Jesse Johnson, who is one of those people that is just gifted with the ability to preach, was preaching on Elijah in the cave, you know, where we talk about the still small voice is usually the translation we use there. And he said, actually, the Hebrew is actually much closer to the word whisper. And it just resonated with me in a way that I would not have been able to articulate if I hadn't heard that sermon. This idea that God speaks to me in whispers. And it was that sermon that sort of made me realize that for years I had been hoping to have a farm, a place where people could come and get rest and, you know, fill up their wells, to use that analogy, and just take a break, you know, step away and contemplate a little bit. And so I move forward a few years, and my mom passes away, and my father said, you know, Andy, your mom and I had saved all this money so that we could travel when we retired, and now she's not here, and I don't know what to do with it. So what I've decided I want to do is I want to help you and your brother, I have a brother who's a couple years younger than me, live your dreams. What do you want more than anything? And I said, a farm. And he said, okay. And so 2 weeks later, he bought me a farm. And it was amazing. We found, you know, a farm that unfortunately someone had lost to foreclosure, but it was a good price and it was near my dad, you know, so that was important to me and it still is. I still live within an hour of him. He gave just so much, you know, so my brother got slighted. He helped my sister through business school and things, so sister-in-law. So, but we bought this place and then for the next year and a half, my dad and I rehabilitated it. It had fallen into disrepair. And so we redid the house and we redid, there were 10 acres. We fixed those up, put fencing in and we just got it ready. And then I met the man who's now my husband. Mm-hmm. And one of our first conversations was, can you buy into this? Because if you can't buy into this, I'm just not sure this, you know, you and I will work, because mm-hmm. I think this is me. And he said, oh yeah, I'm totally in. Mm-hmm. So he was. We got engaged 6 months later and married just a year after we met, and not even quite a year after we met. And we got goats and we got chickens, mm-hmm. and then my husband said, I don't think I can do a 50-mile each way commute. And so we moved the whole farm about 8 months ago to almost 2 hours north of where we were, to Madison County, Virginia, which sits right on the edge of the Blue Ridge Mountains. And we have 15 acres here, and we have 6 goats and 26 chickens, 4 dogs and 4 cats. And we just built a barn, and the place is now here, and it exists to be a place of refuge and respite. And we grow crops and we, you know, we will breed our goats and milk goats, so it is a working farm, but mostly it's a retreat space for people who need a break. So, you know, people in ministry who constantly are asked for things, you know, mm-hmm. Artists who maybe work a lot of hours and don't have a lot of time for their art. And our goal is to always make it as affordable as possible so people can come. So this past weekend we had a writer's retreat, and there were 5 writers who gathered here and came Friday night and stayed till Sunday, and we did workshops, and a mutual friend of ours, Sean Smucker, came and gave a reading, and we had a bunch of people from the community come, and for Sean's reading we had over 30 people here at a bonfire, and we had a potluck dinner. And I looked around that fire and thought, yep, this is exactly it. Exactly. So in time we'll have a bunk room in our barn so people can come and stay. There'll be a kitchen and a bathroom in there. Mm-hmm. So we're introverts, so we are good at pretty much guarding our space, so we stay healthy, but there will be space for people to come and be, and the fee will be very minimal, and gone if people can't do that fee, and they'll just get to come and be here and, you know, hear the rooster crow and hang out with the goats and do whatever they need to do. You know, there's no application, you know, we have no expectation that people are going to produce a certain amount of work, like many writers' residencies. Mm-hmm. It's just a place for people to come and rest.
Sounds beautiful. Like an oasis. I think that people need that more than ever. It seems that all the feedback I'm getting as I speak with artists and writers and people who tend to create things, I keep hearing the same sorts of things. I need to unplug. This is more valuable to me than it was before, and getting the solace and solitude is just completely key to like, I think it is another soul care issue. It's just like, are you going to take, is it going to be well with your soul? And then knowing what that takes, which is sometimes just attention back to, you know, helps to be in nature sometimes for people. Like, I feel like I'm in my body again and not just always in my head, and so yeah. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, we're very excited. We're probably 3 or 4 months away from having it sort of up and running. And, you know, we have longer term goals. You know, the barn right now has a gravel floor and we'd like concrete. You know, there's things down the road. But, you know, within 8 months, we've pretty much got it here. And the retreat this weekend proved we could do it, you know. So we're very excited. And, you know, I wrote a book called God's Whisper Manifesto when I was first starting the farm. And it sort of lays out the 10 principles we have here, like as green as possible without being stupid, mm-hmm. you know, being kind, being loving is not always easy. You know, sometimes loving is hard. Respect for everyone. You know, so we try to operate on it. You know, anybody is welcome, no matter what your faith practice or any of those things. We respect where you are, and we try to cook food or have food available that meets your dietary needs. And you know, we'll give you space as you need it, and we'll have conversation as you need it. And that's what we try to do.
Yeah, I know you, so when you have retreats and things like that, you have a teaching background and you're doing some workshops and things like that. And so what are some of those things that you're covering as you work with writers?
We're doing a lot. I work a lot with newer writers, mm-hmm. although I love working with, I really like working with more experienced writers too, because that feeds me a lot. But we do a lot about making, you know, honoring the need to do creative work and not feeling guilty about that for taking time to do that. We do just conversations about goal setting. You know, I think a lot of us feel a lot of time anxiety, and we're always feeling like we don't have enough time. And so we talk about, you know, how to make time, how to set goals so that you actually do make the time to do the writing you want to do. We do craft workshops at the retreat this weekend. We did a 3-hour writing workshop where everybody brought some pages and we talked about those pages. And ultimately, the goal is to hopefully help people do the work they want and connect them to other people who are doing that work, so they don't, you know, writers can feel really isolated. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, the retreat helps us feel a little bit less isolated.
Yeah. And then, what would you tell somebody who might not be able to come out to Virginia, but they feel sort of creatively stuck or something like that? Are there things that have helped you?
Yeah, I think that building silence into our days is really important. I think one of the things that makes us feel stuck is that we're always, or at least this is true for me, and I think it's true for other people, we're always, like you said, in our heads. And our heads are pretty frenzied, mm-hmm. frenetic, moving places. And art comes from a stiller place. And so I think building silence in, and silence isn't like, you know, a sensory deprivation tank, although I kind of think that would be nice too. But, you know, just quiet, you know, if that does mean you need to get up in the morning, so you have young children and you need to beat them out of bed, maybe you do that for 15 minutes, or maybe it's, you know, lunch break where you go put on soothing music and sit on a park bench. You know, I think that's important. But I also just think doing some stuff, you know, to kickstart yourself. So I use poems as a way to sort of start my daily writing practice, and I'm very blessed to be able to have a daily writing practice. But you might take a poem and pick a line that really resonates with you, kind of like Lectio Divina from Scripture, and use that line, copy it down, and then just start writing what comes to mind from there. Sometimes that can really help kind of clear out that frenzy to get to the deeper stuff. And I also think it takes listening and knowing your own voice, like the real voice, not the teacher voice or the doctor voice or the whatever voice, you know, that's that authority voice that we put on, but the one that really speaks from our hearts. I think that's the voice we need to hear, and then I also think that's the voice our readers need to hear. And it just takes practice to start being able to know when that voice speaks.
Yeah, that's juicy right there. I wanna poke at that a little bit more. And when you say your real voice, you think that, I guess I'm thinking that the things that can cloud that over or obscure it, you know, could be like your expectations of yourself or other people's expectations of you, probably. What are some of the things that you think make it hard to find the true you, I guess, is really kind of what we're talking about.
Right. I mean, I do think a lot of it's expectations. I think You know, like Anne Lamott and Natalie Goldberg talk a lot about the ugly voices or the monkey minds, but I think we all carry around the voices of people in our lives whose opinions we value a lot, but who have not always been affirming to us.
Hmm.
You know, whether it's a parent that wasn't affirming or a teacher or a partner. I think sometimes those voices can be very, very loud, and our voices can be very, very small. And I think, too, we also lay on ourselves a lot of, somebody this weekend at the retreat said, don't should on yourself. And I thought, that's a pretty good explanation right there. You know, like this, we should be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
I should be making more money. I should be writing a book that will sell. I should be trying to build my blog reader, whatever it is, you know, whatever we think we should be spending our time doing. And that should voice is not the real voice. I think our real voice is the voice that I don't know, for me, I feel it in my fingers. My fingers get tingly. And, you know, that voice that we can just take delight in. Sean Smucker said something this weekend that he'd read in Andre Nouwen, and Nouwen had said, what if God takes delight in the things you take delight in? And I thought, gosh, what a profound question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think sometimes we, in our society, we're, you know, we live that good Protestant work ethic in a really deep way. So if you're just resting, or you're just wandering around in the yard, or you're, you know, just reading a book because you just want to read it, like we think we're not doing the right thing. And when we don't do those things that give us joy, I think it's harder to hear who we really are.
Mm. How true. I think the idea of should, it's a very anxiety, potentially, I think usually, anxiety producing question to ask yourself. Is like, you know, what should I be doing, or am I doing what I should be doing? And it winds up, you know, somebody said, I don't know who it is, this is where I should look up, this is where I should look up stuff more, but that there's no such thing as writer's block. It's actually just some form of fear. And I could see that. I don't know if that's 100% true or 100% true for everyone, but I can see how as those expectations or those shoulds for us creep in, that the fear will start to mount, and then you can get really paralyzed because what if you don't do it right, or what, you know, like there's all these like kind of or fearful outcomes or something, instead of just, you know, who am I really, and what, you know, what has sometimes from our greatest wounds come our, I mean, that's the wounded healer, that's Henri Nouwen as well, where sometimes our real self is someone who's just persevered and has a message, but, you know, maybe it's a message that we don't think people care about or people would receive, maybe. And there's a lot of, winds up being a lot of barriers when you're trying to get down to the root of who you are. And I guess that's the nice thing about a writer's retreat, is that you have permission to dig around and experiment and not have to, you know, in privacy, where you're in a nurturing environment and not, you know, under the gun to produce. And I know I had a literary agent for several years, a really prominent one. And in the end, although he was fantastic and presented ideas to different publishers for me, right as the publishing industry was imploding, I felt very stuck creatively by having, and he wasn't like, you know, over my shoulder, what are you creating now? He would just wait there patiently as a, you know, like a fine human being. But in my mind, I was like, I bet I'm disappointing him. I bet he's wondering if he's going to hear from me. It just tripped me up big time. And I thought, this is the most counterintuitive thing, to let a literary agent go. But I was like, everybody wants one. Like you wouldn't believe, you know, everybody's clamoring, how do I get one? And I had one. And then I was like, yeah, but it's not, this isn't just, this just isn't working. And it's it might seem silly to let it go, but I just couldn't be myself, it felt like, at least at that point in time.
That's right. Yeah. No. I would, if he's available, you can pass him to me. But yeah, I don't. I think we do that. I think our own. I think those voices that other people have laid on us are sometimes there, but I also think usually it's our own voice. And I think you may be thinking of Stephen Pressfield's The War of Art, where he talks a lot about fear and resistance as the things that slow us down. So yeah, it's definitely, I think the key is to just know ourselves and know that we're good and that we're loved. Mm-hmm. And if we are, then how can that be, how can what we take true joy in really be bad? You know?
Yeah, and it does seem like when we start creating from that place, in a sense, it's creating for ourselves and our own joy, which is God's delight. And then other people, it clicks with them too, and they realize there's a universality in it that people sort of know this deep-seated authenticity, and they're drawn to it. And even though you didn't produce it for them, it finds a home with them. And yes. I've noticed, you know, in when you're least expecting it, you're just creating for the joy of it. People, that there's an overflow of love and joy that like splashes onto people, and they're like, oh, well, that's, I love what you're doing. Let me know more. And it was something created, you know, in the absence of fear. So it's this funny letting go thing. And I guess that kind of is a life lesson too, that could probably apply to a lot of things. The more we're grasping onto something, you know, the sort of the more it stays out of our grasp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So in terms of your own sort of spiritual formation, and I should have maybe kicked off with this, but what was your faith tradition background, if you had one, and how was your spirituality evolved? I mean, this is like not a life story kind of question. I suppose it could end up being that, but in the sense of like, where did you start off, and where are you now? And I'm always curious as to people's backgrounds in terms of, you know, where they've come from.
Yeah, sure. My parents are Christians. My mom was a church minister. And their rule of thumb when we were children was go where the community is the best. And so they're Protestant, and but that was really the only, I mean, I'm not even sure they would have said they wouldn't go to a Catholic church, a Roman Catholic church, mm-hmm. but they just looked for a church where the community was strong and where they could connect with people primarily, and then sort of adhere to whatever the church teachings were. So mm-hmm. when I was tiny, I was baptized Methodist in Canada, mm-hmm. and then I was baptized Presbyterian when I was in junior high, and then I was baptized Southern Baptist, and then I went to college and on my own tradition. I went to Messiah College, which is a Brethren in Christ school, and the Anabaptist tradition is the tradition I call mine now. And I'm not evangelical anymore, and that's not a judgment on anyone's faith walk. I just am not in a place where I'm thinking that way. I just consider myself a Christian, and I'm pretty into Jesus, and I believe I'm Orthodox in my belief, but I'm also very aware that where I was born and to whom I was born has affected what my faith tradition is. And so, you know, I try to learn from everybody I can, and you know, my husband and I don't have a church. We will probably find one. But he was raised, his father is conservative Brethren, so like another good Anabaptist, and his mom is Catholic. And so he kind of grew up between those traditions, and I grew up in a ton of them. So we bounce around and look for churches that, you know, meet the needs we have. And then we'd spend a lot of time in community with other believers, just connecting with them and, you know, trying to discern a path and a way of being in the world that is honoring to God and honoring to other people. So maybe, I don't like to use the word transcendent, that sounds very holy, but I just think we're sort of standing, we're sitting in a place outside of a traditional Christian church teaching at this point, and I'm actually good with that. So, mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's no anywhere you wanted to go with that's fine with me. Yeah, and I think a lot of people feel sort of post-evangelical, or in terms of how it's been defined in this last 100 years. I think it changed quite a bit to the original evangelicals, you know, I'm not that far away from Messiah College, and you know, I have some friends who've gone to school there or who work there now, and then when I went to seminary in Myerstown, Pennsylvania, kind of between Lebanon and Reading, Pennsylvania, it's one of these places that's out of the Methodist tradition. There's a lot of United Methodists there, but the Dean of Academic Programs, who was on earlier on one of my episodes, Lori Mellinger, she's Mennonite Anabaptist, and there's a whole collection of people, and the president, who's also a friend of mine, his name's Tony Blair, from the United Brethren background, has a church now that's not, I don't believe it's United Brethren, but he says, I hope I don't butcher this, I'm a 19th century evangelical, I think is how he says it, in that term of the word, of just the basic, not a political thing, it's just the basic, I want to tell the good news. I want you to know the good news of Jesus and reconciliation with God. And the term evangelical has been totally hijacked and by the media too. Like anytime you see something horrible happen, you'll see like the word evangelical stuck next to it. But it's the, some of these labels are breaking down, and you have some big spectrums within each, you know, each label, you'll have a wide spectrum of understanding and belief. And so I don't know that all of them work anymore. Like kind of like you're saying, you find yourself sort of on the outside of some of the what have been institutions or doctrinal structures or something, and then you find yourself, you know, pulling from other sources and other places to find where God is speaking in those situations. I find myself in much the same spot too, in many ways. But yeah, that's the influence. And then as far as Anabaptist is concerned, are you also appreciate the peace movement and some of those just social justice issues that are often reflected within that tradition?
Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, I think that's probably why I moved towards the Mennonite church, is that peace tradition helps me sit in a place of acceptance and gentleness, mm-hmm. that is hard for me to find in other denominations. That doesn't mean it's not there, just where I've been, it hasn't been easy for me. And so mm-hmm. that really matters to me. And I also appreciate that social justice tradition as separate from government. That is a place that I feel very comfortable taking action out of my faith in a way that I wouldn't necessarily feel comfortable taking action as part of a government movement. So that tradition, and then it also is not, you know, the practice of worship in a Mennonite or an Anabaptist tradition is something I just adore. I just love that 19th century evangelical. I might have to steal that, but I feel very comfortable in a, you know, even like an old order Mennonite congregation where there are no instruments and the men and women are separated and for worship, and you know, the preaching is extemporaneous. That I feel that just speaks to my soul in a very real way. And I also appreciate that there's usually good food afterwards.
Yeah, the love feast. That's familiar, right? So yeah, explain that to people who don't know what that is.
Well, it's a, you know, in many old order traditions, particularly in Pennsylvania, you know, near where you are, they do a big meal afterwards. And it depends on the church. You know, some of them are just like, you know, good old church potluck and everybody brings some food. And sometimes it's two or three families and they cook all week to be able to put on a meal for a congregation. And it's amazing. And, you know, and then sometimes it comes with a foot washing, which I think is a tradition many of us have lost, and I wish we hadn't. But just this idea of sitting down at a meal together, breaking bread and having real conversation and community, and everyone's welcome. And I just find that just life-giving in a way. I think we've lost that, you know, in our hurried culture. We move so quickly. We don't sit and talk over meals very often, and I like Love Feast for that.
Yeah, I grew up from the time I was about 7 or 8 until I was done with high school. I was involved in a really small, what they would call assemblies, almost out of a Plymouth Brethren tradition, where there's no pastor and there's no, like, there's no paid staff or anything like that. And once a month, and that was, you know, it had its good points, and then it had some legalistic points as well. but one of the things we did was the once a month, you know, everybody would bake their pies, and we'd you know, just eat together and take our time. And I don't know any place that does that now remote. I don't know anywhere close to me whatsoever. It would probably be like a really far away, or maybe just a place I don't know about. But, you know, on Sunday, it's like, oh, there's soccer, and there's, you know, soccer practice, and then there's this thing to go to. And I've felt that, you know, people will like almost run out the door right when it's over, and they're like, you know, okay, looking at the clock, okay. And there's no like leisure. And I know that this isn't just my church. This is like a thing, you know, that's happened. But with the idea of bringing a Sabbath rest back and visiting, like people used to do visiting. If you talk to somebody over the age of, you know, probably 60 or 70, they would say on Sundays they would go visiting. Maybe they'd see a few relatives or a few friends that were sort of far flung, and they would just talk all day together and eat. And it was very laid back, and no one was going to need to go shopping, and no one was going to need to, you know, check their email, because there was no email. Mm-hmm. And there's something so beautiful and lost that I think that will wind up swinging back the other way if it hasn't already. And I'm just not aware of it. But that's a beautiful thing to actually slow down that much, that you don't have to be anywhere except for where you are.
Yes. Yeah, that's, I think that's very true.
Part of that Love Feast and part of that meal is people aren't getting a quick bite to eat to head off somewhere else. I think the whole idea is that we're going to spend some time together now for some hours and let it and just kick back. And there's you know, there's got to be something like that more. I think what happens sometimes with church then is that you feel like you're always sort of missing each other. You're saying hello and you're kind of friends, but you stop knowing people. And I'm just speaking for myself. but you know, if it's transient in your interactions, you know, they become shallow just out of the nature of, you know, the social nature of us and everything. And I kind of feel myself longing for that again too. So I might have to do some sort of rebellious potluck or something.
Right. Well, that's what we did. That was what was really wonderful here on Saturday. We did, and that's part of that idea of a Love Feast is what I have in mind when we do meals here. And Saturdays, if there are people here, we always do a meal together. That's sort of the rule. And Saturday night, we had so much food, so much food. But everybody brought things, and people sat around, and you know, there's no. I think we also have the cultural assumption that we're going to entertain people. You know, if people come to your house, you have to keep them busy. And we're really fighting that here because of what you're saying. It takes a certain amount of time to sort of settle into a comfortable place with people. So we mow part of our hay field, and the kids play wiffle ball, and we have a couch in the barn, and people lay on the couch, and we talk, and we eat, and we always leave 2 hours. because I mean, you can eat in 20 minutes, we all know that, but like you 2 hours gives everybody time to socialize and talk to other people and relax, and I just miss that too.
Yeah, that's great that you're bringing. See, you're really doing church where you are, and in the spiritual formation way is that, you know, these, and I think the early church kind of got started in people's homes, and there was food, and you know that these little house churches, not that they all have to be like that now, but there was something that formed community by doing that and formed, you know, belonging and identity and these very nurturing things for our soul that wind up being life-changing because you feel loved, I guess. And yeah, that's, I love to hear that. Now I'm gonna be like racking my brain, how can I do that in my little town? Could I do a picnic? I'm gonna like figure it out.
That's right.
but yeah, we can all figure out like what that looks like in our own, you know, our own neighborhoods, our own context. But yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. So if somebody wants to find out more about what you're up to, where can they reach you?
Sure. My website is just andylitt, andylit.com, and all the stuff I do as a writer and a editor, coach, all these people is on there. But we also have a section for the farm, and you can read about what events we have coming up. We're doing a craft show, and then there's an event coming in December. A woman named Philistine Lawson is coming to read from her book, Quilt of Souls. We'll probably do another event in the fall. So we do all kinds of events, but we also just have, you know, spontaneous come over. We're going to grill out and bring some food, and we'll hang out. And we do always do bonfires. So you can find out all that information there, and there's a way to contact me there as well.
That's really good. And I'll have show notes to this episode where everything's kind of lined up of your books and all your stuff that you're working on from that place too. But this was fun. Now I'll have to visit. We have a pop-up. Maybe we'll drive out and pop up or something.
By all means, please do. We're always welcome to have, we have, you know, all this land, and we'd love for people to camp out here. We, you know, we let you camp in the hayfield so you don't have to deal with cows around the camper. That's our rule.
That's great. I know we have a little, it's a pretty rural area where I live in. It's just little tiny towns, kind of near the Appalachian Trail in what are the coal regions of the United States. So the anthracite coal regions of we 3 miles up the road is Yingling Brewery, the oldest brewery in America, and it's I think 6 generations old. And it, you know, this is how the miners who came here from all different, you know, parts of the world to get a better life, this is how they coped with being a miner before, you know, there was any protection from the industrialists. And so there's a lot of history in this area, and there's a lot of farming and rural stuff as well as this sort of mining heritage. But my son just went to the little Schuylkill County Fair. It's Schuylkill County. It's above Reading. It's this little kind of, you know, underpopulated area. And he said, I said, did you get to pet animals? And he said, yeah, but not the cows. And I'm like, no, what happened? They were not there, and I couldn't pet the cows. It was like, oh no. I'm going to have to find a baby cow somewhere so he could pet this cow.
That's
So yeah,
when you come here, the neighbor's cows are shy, so you can pet goats, which is kind of like petting a small cow.
So. Oh, that's great. And so you have, you're going to be, do you milk them, and do you?
We will be. We're going to, we have, they're a year old now, and so we were going to do them in the fall, but we moved. And so, you know, pregnant goats on a truck is not really a good idea. So we will breed them this fall, and then we'll have babies in January or February. And then we'll start milking. They have to deliver before they're ready to milk. And then I don't know what we'll do with the milk. Just drink a lot of it maybe, and make goat's milk. So, but I'm really interested in trying that. Part of the farm is that it makes me slow down and makes me be more deliberate. You know, I was a professor for years, and there's nothing slow about being a professor. Mm-hmm. So I would like to be able to use this place. You know, the garden does that, and the animals do that. Nothing like gathering eggs to make you realize the miracle of life. So
yeah, and it's on its own time. Like nature is on its own time. Whether you can be rushed, but it doesn't mean that that's going to change, you know, the seasons and how the animals are adjusting in their environment. It does slow you down. I just stopped working at a vineyard, which is also a farm in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And there's mm-hmm. sheep and there's cows and there's goats, and you know they need regular care in regular cycles, but also you can't rush them. You can't right. hurry them along. They're part of nature. They're not gonna care about your schedule.
That's right, exactly. That's what people, our neighbors, we have a little farm stand in our neighbor's house. Like, when are you gonna get more eggs? I'm like, when the chickens lay them. Like, I cannot. You know, I can't. My husband always jokes he's gonna squeeze the chickens, and like, they lay eggs when they lay eggs. Like, there's nothing.
You're not the boss of them. They just will do it when they're doing.
Oh, we're definitely not the boss of them.
Oh, Andy, thank you so much for speaking with me, and we'll definitely keep in touch and hopefully make a visit down. And if you ever want to come to the Anthracite Coal Regions of Pennsylvania, you're more than welcome at our home too.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa, and thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
I really hope you enjoyed the show today. Please come by sparkmymuse.com for related show notes and links and all kinds of other information. Don't forget to subscribe, and please give us 5 stars on iTunes.